This is Festival Showcase, a weekly interview program that explores the artists and music behind the 2015 season of the Aspen Music Festival and School and previews upcoming performances. This program comes to you from Aspen Public Radio, the official voice of the Aspen Music Festival and School, and can also be heard online at aspenpublicradio.org. Today we'll talk with guitarist Sharon Isbin about her new DVD, her upcoming concert August 6th with Stanley Jordan and Romero Lubombo here in Aspen, and her thoughts on the recent Supreme Court decision on marriage equality. Then we'll talk with two young pianists from the Happy Dog Duo, and finally composer Stephen Stuckey. So here's guitarist Sharon Isbin. We'll also hear her play with Stanley Jordan and Romero Lubombo in duets from her Guitar Passion CD, Sonidos de Aquel Día and Charendo da Rosera. Well, Sharon, one of the things I love about the concerts that you bring to Aspen is that you expose us to really great guitarists that we may not be familiar with. We get into this classical music world and this mindset, and then all of a sudden this great jazz artist or this great Brazilian artist or whoever it is comes in. Is that one of the things that you're trying to do, not only for yourself as an artist, but for us as an audience to sort of expand our audio horizons?
Well, the concert that I'm doing here on August 6th is one that I've actually just toured 20 cities with both of my colleagues, Romero Lubombo from Brazil and Stanley Jordan, the American jazz guitarist. So we're really kind of coming to Aspen after having had a year playing together. It's exciting to be able to bring it to a community that has embraced all kinds of styles of music. And one of the things that's special about this program is that it mixes jazz with bossa nova, with classical and Latin music. So, for example, it also has different pairings. There's seven different relationships that happen in the course of this concert. So we have each of us play together as a trio, we each pair off in duos, and then we each can do solos. So those combinations give a lot of variety. And at one point, Stanley even plays the piano while he plays the guitar at the same time. Just imagine that.
Spoiler alert, everybody.
Yeah.
That sounds like a lot of fun. And I think I imagine for you as an artist, that classical guitar, pure classical guitar by itself, seems like it's not enough. And especially in the world that we live in today, where world music is becoming so important, even to contemporary classical composers.
Well, actually, with this whole approach to different styles and genres, I go back to the 1980s, where I began working with Jobim, one of the composers whose music will play in the concert. And I actually had a trio with Laurindo Almeida from Brazil and Larry Coryell. So Laurindo set the slow movement, Rodrigo Adagio, for us to play together. And now I've resurrected that to do with Stanley and Romero. So instead of the big orchestral solo at the end of that slow movement adagio from the Concierto de Aranjuez, it becomes this incredible improv in a bossa nova style and a jazz style and almost a rock style, where Stanley plays electric guitar and Romero and I are doing the bossa chords. So it's pretty exciting and a different flavor. And Romero is doing some of the jazz improvised English horn solos while I'm playing the part Rodrigo wrote, and Stanley is improvising along the way. So it's different each time, and very fun for me to be part of that spontaneity.
I listen to you either live or on some of your CDs where you're doing these artistic collaborations. I'm just going to make a guess that you are attracted to working with musicians who are of a very, very high technical caliber, but also have a lot of heart. And with each of these, you know, in spite of the different three genres that are represented on the stage, the three of you have a lot in common as well as a lot that separates you.
True. And actually, we go back quite a ways. I had done a tour with Stanley called Guitar Summit back in the 90s. And with Romero, we first met playing on the stage of Carnegie Hall for a tribute to Jobim, who had just passed away the year before. And we were asked to do his music, since both of us were friends with Jobim and had worked and collaborated with him.
The other thing, too, is that when you talk about Stanley Jordan, I mean, jazz musicians live and thrive on improvisation. And I've taught to some very famous classical musicians who couldn't improvise their way through the simplest imaginable chord progression. Does it help you to associate with musicians who have such mastery of improvisation, and does that find its way into your playing?
Well, what we've managed to do is find music that we can play that allows them to improvise. It doesn't mm-hmm. put me on that same level because I don't have the same training that they do in terms of being able to be a jazz improviser, but I can find works where it gives them that freedom, and that's the secret for each of us to do what we do best.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So choosing the music is a very important part of what brings our program together.
And how do audiences respond in the Aspen area? Is the audience a different mix than they would be when they just come to see Sharon Isbin?
Yes, the audience is always one that is going to combine people who know me and then who are fans of both the jazz world and the bossa world. Mm-hmm. So it's really fun. They go nuts because they've never heard anything quite like this before. We're almost inventing a new kind of genre coming together.
Now, with Romero and Stanley, we have a Brazilian who's very steeped in the bossa nova tradition and the rhythms of that. Is that pretty easy for Stanley to pick up and to be able to just kind of jump into that kind of Brazilian rhythm too? Or?
Well, when they play together, it's wild. It's really wonderful mm-hmm. to hear. And of course, Romero does more than only Brazilian style. So they've done a variety of different duets on our tour, and each one is quite different.
And it sounds like, since you have the soloist, we're going to hear perhaps pure jazz, pure classical from you, pure Brazilian or bossa nova from Romero. Is that true? In addition to the blending of your styles.
Well, and they're both composers too. That's what makes it so exciting because they each compose a lot of their own music. That will come across in the program as well. So then, of course, they'll improvise on what they've composed.
Right.
That really is different each time.
And speaking of composers, to my knowledge, you're not a composer. But you have inspired some of the greatest composers alive today to write for the guitar, for your instrument. And I'm wondering if there's anybody out there working on trying to figure out how to write for the classical guitar right now for some kind of concerto or whatever for you.
Well, I just premiered a fabulous new concerto by Chris Brubeck, who mm-hmm. is one of the sons of Dave Brubeck.
Uh-huh.
And it's a work I did in April, the world premiere, with the Maryland Symphony conducted by Elizabeth Scholes, who's certainly mm-hmm. a veteran and prize winner here of the Aspen Music Festival,
yes.
and a wonderful conductor. So she had done a lot of Chris's music, and it was really a natural to choose that partnership and orchestral force as one that would be something Chris wanted, and as well I, to bring to life his new piece. So we had a chance to have a number of rehearsals before the performance that week. The work is inspired certainly by Chris's background as a jazz musician.
Mm-hmm.
There's a slow section in the middle. It's all in one movement, but with various different stages that have not only the jazz inflection, but a real Middle Eastern groove that is quite exciting and fun, some great funky rhythms. And the middle section is inspired by a ballad that his father wrote.
Mm-hmm.
So his father had passed away, Dave Brubeck, the year before. So this is an homage, that section, of course, to his father. And it's really, the audience went nuts. It's a kind of piece that's really going to be a big hit. In November, I'm doing another premiere by Richard Danielpour. This is a commission by Carnegie Hall for their 125th anniversary. They asked what composer I wanted. And this is for a concert I'm doing with Isabel Leonard, who performed with me here in Aspen last summer and is coming again to perform with the orchestra. And we're doing a whole recital program. We've been touring together since Aspen. That was our debut together.
Well, I was going to ask you that because I know you did. Isabel Leonard was in a way you incubated it here.
That's right.
At that concert, and then took it somewhere else. Now this one, you've been traveling around and you're bringing it to us, which is great.
That's right. So
great direction.
Richard has written a beautiful song cycle based on Rumi poetry. His background is Persian. So we'll premiere that in New York on November 12th at Carnegie Hall, and then bring it to the Harris Theater Chicago, which is a co-commissioner with Carnegie, and then continue it on for the other programs that we do this season.
You had last year, I think you premiered, as it were, a CD called Sharon Isbin Troubadour, or a DVD rather, the movie. And that has come out commercially now, so maybe you can tell us a little bit about that. Some of us saw it here.
Right.
And there's more to it than just the DVD or the movie version, I guess, that you showed us.
Well, when it screened in Aspen at Pepke Auditorium last summer, it was the one-hour film, and it was then presented by American Public Television across the country on almost 200 stations and really seen by millions of people. It even aired on Colorado Public Television a number of different times. So it has been exciting to see it gang legs since the Aspen screening, and now in April and May, it was released by Video Artists International on DVD and on Blu-ray. And so even if you saw the film in the screening or television, the DVD and Blu-ray have 30 minutes extra performances, including this fun duet set that I do with Romero Lubambo.
Sharon, some of your guitar concerts are more like ecumenical conferences, and it's wonderful to see that. And I just wanted to ask how it affects you as a musician to work so closely and collaborate so closely with people who come from such different worlds of music.
I love the challenge of that. And of mm-hmm. course, the kinds of collaborators I choose are people whose music I love and I'm drawn to. So whether it's Mark O'Connor or Isabel Leonard, or Stanley Jordan, or Romero Lubambo, or Steve Vai. These are people who, even though what they do is very different from me, it's something that I feel that I can participate in and contribute to.
Does it change the way that you, in any way, do you feel, on some subtle level perhaps, that you play classical guitar a little bit differently? For example, Latin American classical guitar composers, there must be some crossover between that and some of the kind of music Romero plays, for example.
Well, certainly, if I'm playing with a real Brazilian like mm-hmm. Romero, and his sense of rhythm is so fantastic, as was Tiago de Mello, with whom mm-hmm. I had performed for many years, a Brazilian composer and percussionist, it most definitely influences the way I hear the music and the way I feel it.
A real shift of gears here, but this is major year with the U.S. Supreme Court decision to legalize gay and lesbian marriages across the country. I know you came out, I think it was in Out magazine or something, about 20 years ago, and it had very little impact in terms of the sense that it wasn't even a big shock even 20 years ago. But today, this must be a very rewarding time for you, and I just wanted to ask you a little bit about your response to that.
Well, I think, of course, it's wonderful that the rights that so many other citizens in the United States have had now have been extended to everyone, and that's mm-hmm. that's the way it should be. It's also interesting timing because the documentary on me, Troubadour, has been released this year as well, in that the filmmaker wanted to include a section from where I was a guest on The L Word on Showtime, mm-hmm. and it talked a little bit about my process of coming out. So I don't expect to go to Russia anytime soon, where things aren't so favorable, or
right.
other countries where one could be killed for that. But in the United States, it's really great to be part of the vanguard of those who have the courage to be who they are and to enjoy life as they are, and to encourage others to similarly find their own passion and to really enjoy the freedom that we have in this country, which is not something to take for granted in so many other parts of the world. And there's still certainly a lot left to be done. I mean, when you consider the very, very high suicide attempt rate amongst gay youth, just having gay marriage isn't going to solve that. But it will certainly set an example from the very top, from the presidency, from mm-hmm. the Supreme Court, that lives matter and that whatever choices one makes, that is legitimate and that is something to be respected.
Well, Sharon, we look forward very, very much to your concert or your ecumenical conference, as I call it. And thank you so much for coming into Aspen Public Radio and sharing your time with us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
If you've just joined us, this is Festival Showcase on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Chris Moore, and I've been talking with guitarist Sharon Isbin. Now let's hear two brilliant young piano students from the Aspen Music Festival and School, Eric Tran and Nathan Chung, who call themselves the Happy Dog Duo. Well, Eric and Nathan, I've seen you both individually and as the Happy Dog Duo, so the first mm-hmm. question I have mm-hmm. to ask for the two of you playing piano together is where the name Happy Dog Duo even arose from.
Well, there's a sort of story that goes behind this. One day, Eric had just competed in a competition in Colorado, and I was accompanying him, and we were flying back. And on the airplane, mm-hmm. we decided to
write a joint composition. So basically that means that I would write a measure of a piece.
And then, I would write another measure of the piece.
And then I would write the next measure.
And the next measure.
You guys look like a good team for a piano duo.
Yeah. And so okay. we finished a composition, our first composition.
Yeah, it was a joint composition. And we decided to title it
Happy Dog.
Not the Happy Dog, just Happy Dog.
Happy Dog.
Right. And then you decided to call yourselves the Happy Dog Duo after that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we were considering other names, too, like the really, really cool duo or the super awesome duo or duo fantastic, but, you know.
Happy Dog just kind of, I think about a dog, you know, rub my belly. You know,
yeah.
It's great. So
it's a friendly image, right?
It is. It's a very friendly image. Did you have to overcome the fact that you're just like crossing hands over each other and bumping into each other and that sort of thing? It's very close quarters up there.
That's very true.
That's part of the fun, I think. I don't know.
Yeah. Right. It's very effective to work together, choreography and seeing where the other partner's hands are supposed to be in terms of memorizing how the music should be played. It actually, in a way, is an advantage to learning the music.
Also,
I can imagine,
you know, we'll sometimes just like elbow each other when something's supposed to happen. You know, like, hey. Yes.
Hey, don't forget your part here.
Yeah.
Do you get to swap? I mean, is one of you always playing the bass, or do you swap sides?
We generally stay with the same roles.
Yeah, I see.
Usually I play on the upper register, and Nathan plays on the lower register of the piano. Mm-hmm. But
yeah. You know. The one time I saw you, Eric was up there playing the soprano melodies and things like that. Do you have plans, first of all, or hopes of being the Happy Dog Duo 20 years from now and playing piano, four hands, playing music for two pianos? Or do you see you're going off in other trajectories at the same time, at least?
All of the above.
Wow.
Yes.
Okay.
Everything at once.
Happy Dog Duo will take over the world.
Right. I oftentimes think of the life of a concert pianist as being a lone wolf kind of a job because you travel around, you don't really get to meet a lot of other pianists because when one pianist leaves, the next one comes in or whatever. And so, but you're not the lone wolf soloist all the time. You get to be the Happy Dog Duo. I'm sure you enjoy your lone wolf times as well, but at the same time, do you enjoy it just from a social perspective to be able to feel, you know, a human connection with someone else and not just be alone in a hotel room every time you travel?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's a really good reminder to remember that when you play music, you are playing for other people. And that is, for me, a big inspiration when I perform because it's not meant to be just entirely saved for oneself, I think.
And I have to say that I feel most comfortable playing with Nathan instead of solo. Sometimes when you're by yourself, you have this a little paranoia, you know, you're like, oh, no, something.
Right.
But here, you know, you think something might go wrong. But here with Nathan, I know things will go wrong. So, you know.
Right. Well, I've asked this question sometimes to violinists or solo pianists, whatever, of things that have gone wrong. Funny stories, I guess you might say, of things that have happened in your travels. And it seems like you can double that opportunity when you're the Happy Dog Duo. So do you have any things that have perhaps been a bit of a challenge for you to get through the concert as a result of something happening that we might enjoy hearing about?
We have a few stories, a few moments.
You can't be called Happy Dog Duo and not have some happy occurrences.
Right.
Okay. Remember one time we were in a contest, a competition, and we were going to play the Schubert F minor fantasy, such a serious and grave,
serious work,
tragic piece. Yes.
Right.
Except that when we bowed and we were walking to the
stage,
bench, we kind of tripped over each other.
Yeah, one of us tripped over the other and we acted as if nothing went wrong, bowed, did our bow, went to the seats.
And but we couldn't stop laughing.
We could not stop laughing.
It was like we're about to play, you know, like,
so
like
much.
Hamlet, Macbeth sort of
thing. Yeah, I'd place my hands on the piano and then start laughing and then take them away. And then the other guy, of course, it's contagious, so the other person
so
starts
I start laughing. And we're just on the stage laughing for 30 seconds or a minute before we start the Schubert F minor fantasy.
Yeah.
That was
one of our most memorable difficulties.
Right. That sounds pretty good, actually. And like I said, it does seem to double the chances. I wish you well with the Happy Dog Duo because I don't feel like we hear enough of that repertoire, even though there is a vast repertoire for it. There aren't a vast number of people that want to play it, it seems. So I'm glad you're there for that. I hope as your careers take whatever trajectories they do take, that you always find time to be happy dogs together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Nathan Chung and Eric Tran of the Happy Dog Duo. This is Aspen Public Radio Festival Showcase. I'm Chris Moore. Now let's hear Pulitzer Prize-winning composer Stephen Stuckey, whose opera The Classical Style was just premiered in Aspen. Stephen is also composer in residence for the Composition Studies program here at the Aspen Music Festival and School. Well, Steve, first of all, I want to congratulate you on what is a surprisingly successful opera. Surprising in that I didn't think that the subject matter was going to make for a good material for an opera, but it was. The Classical Style was a huge hit. So congratulations on the performance of that here at Aspen Music Festival and School.
Well, thank you, Chris. I think we all agree with you. We were all surprised that you could make an opera from the Classical Style. Right. I thought it was the worst idea I'd ever heard, but was eventually talked into it, and I'm happy I was. We had a lot of fun at the Wheeler with the Aspen Opera Theater Center putting this on. But more important, it turns out the audience had a lot of fun too, and that was what was important.
It seemed to me as though there must have been an enormous challenge to write in those styles. I know Peter Schickele did it with P.D. Hugh Bach, and I've certainly heard other people weave things in, but I've never heard musical ideas and motifs woven in quite that way. And it just seemed to me as though to have the narrative flow continue without interruption while a Beethoven symphony suddenly appears somewhere in the orchestra seemed to have been something that you must have had to work extra hard on.
It was a lot of work, but it was fun too. If anybody wants to know what my favorite pieces from the classical repertoire is, they just have to listen to Classical Style, because mm-hmm. you get up on a Tuesday morning and you've got 70 measures in front of you, right?
Right.
You reach for what's handy. And I don't mean that in a glib way. I mean, you also reach for what's part of your musical soul sometimes. I think it helped me that I grew up in the era of quotation and collage and so on, you know,
yes.
Rockberg, Berio, you know, Druckmann and so
sure.
on. And that's a natural part of me as a person my age. I had a lot of fun actually trying to make the language work. It also helped me. I told somebody, I was sort of joking, but I realize it's true, that 30 or 40 years of teaching sophomore theory finally came in handy.
I was wondering about that too, because you mentioned the voice. There's a voice of the classical style, which is so woven into this that it would be, in a way, scary that your own voice is lost, your own musical voice is lost. That didn't seem to happen either.
Well, my own voice, which is heard occasionally, kind of the creepy heaven music or other things, you know.
Right.
is, of course, even that's a compound of what I've listened to and loved all my life, including music of the 18th and 19th centuries. So mm-hmm. for me, it's not such a stretch to keep those doors open between centuries.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So the other question that I have really doesn't have to do so much with Aspen, but just now that that project is behind you, are you actively working on another major project that at some point we may be able to hear even in Aspen, maybe next year?
Not so soon as next year. We'll hear something sizable next year, I think, but probably an existing piece. I have a librettist who's not Jeremy Denk,
mm-hmm.
Gene Scheer, who's at this moment we speak in Santa Fe for the premiere of his opera with Jennifer Higdon, Cold Mountain. And Gene and I love working together, and we have a gleam in our eye for a full-length opera coming down the pike in a few years. But not having secured the literary rights, I'm not allowed to give you a broad hint.
So if you told me, you would have to kill me.
I would have to kill you,
okay.
Or you would have to kill me.
one
Gene would have to kill me.
Steve, there's exceptions to every rule, like Shostakovich, who found his musical voice around the age of 19 or so. But for a lot of composers, it seems that they don't really settle into their own voice, even the great ones like Beethoven, until they're maybe somewhere way into their 30s, well into their 30s. You have composers who are in their perhaps late teens and into their 20s. How do you help them cultivate their own voice? Or is it more natural to just allow them to have their music teem with reminiscences and the influences of the music around them?
Excellent question. There are people around early 20s who seem to have found a voice already.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's more natural and much more common still to be searching through one's 20s and maybe into one's 30s, or possibly even not searching and just letting nature take its course.
Mm-hmm.
In my own case, I worried a lot about my lack of a voice when I was younger. I stopped worrying, and later on people told me that my music sounded as if I had written it. So apparently along the way, some kind of slow, natural process of maturation. I encourage composers to be interested in other people's music,
mm-hmm.
dead and alive. If it shows, to let it show.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's, in some sense, the fastest way of growing up. Gosh, if you think of historical models, for Beethoven to write a quintet that imitates Mozart, was a super efficient way of getting better, right? That was the normal method in the 18th century. It's not considered the normal method anymore to do outright imitations. But I think the more music you can process through your own music, the richer your language will be and the richer your psychological apparatus will be for communicating in music.
Well, we have one of these young composers here. I don't know if it's proper to even ask your age, but you're young enough. May I ask, Melody, what your age is?
I just turned 31 years old.
31. Okay, yes. So you're at that age where many composers suddenly are finding their voices. This is Melody Erdvers from Australia, right? A Hungarian
yes.
name, but from Australia.
Correct.
You are perhaps one of these composers who is in that transition process, I guess you might say. Can you speak to that experience of which composers have influenced you and how you are allowing your own voice to start blossoming?
It's a very interesting phenomenon, I think. Mm-hmm. My background, I grew up in a musical home, but my parents did not listen to anything from the 21st or really the 20th century except Debussy and Bartok.
Mm-hmm.
So already I was at a disadvantage when I went to university. I didn't know any of the contemporary composers at all. And this has kind of stayed with me. I find it very difficult to naturally go out and pursue like listening to new music from contemporary composers. I'm hugely interested in it, but it's still, there's a barrier for me because it doesn't come naturally.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, Bartok, I adore Debussy. All of those earlier composers, Brahms as well, they definitely have a lot to do with the way that I think about music and harmony and melody. All of those wonderful things.
And does that affect the sound of your composing or what comes out for the audience very much?
I'm not entirely sure. I try to think about that when I'm writing and listening to performances. I try to hear whatever I think it is that might be me, but I think because being the composer of the thing that I'm hearing, it just sounds like natural, my natural language. Like that's what I do, that's what I sound like. I'm not entirely sure how it is that I sound like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I haven't been brave enough to analyze my own music yet.
Maybe that's a good thing.
I think it is.
I could ask either of you, since you're both composers, do you feel a certain incredible exposure of yourself when your music is being performed? One of my composer friends says, I feel like my butt is hanging out on the stage. Steve, do you have that sense also?
Thank you so much for that image, which I'll now carry with me. I do feel very exposed. I am a person who doesn't express lots of emotions directly in face-to-face in daily life. And then when I hear my own pieces, I discover where they went. Music is actually more turbulent or passionate or sentimental or, you know, all the whole range of than I meant for it to be or than I realized while writing it.
Mm-hmm.
That for me is a great reward that one gets to know oneself from another point of view as a listener to one's own music. It is a kind of exposure when you get out there, but the other terrifying part of it is that you're sitting on the stage next to Mozart or Brahms or somebody.
Right.
And that's humiliating, but on the other hand, that's the highest honor we could ask for, so we'd have to step up and take it.
Well, I want to thank both of you for taking the time to come out and share some of your thoughts about the creation of something new in this world of music.
Thank you, Chris.
We've been talking with Pulitzer Prize-winning composer Stephen Stuckey, whose opera The Classical Style was just premiered in Aspen. Stephen is also composer in residence for the Composition Studies Program and brought one of his students along. This has been Festival Showcase, a weekly interview program that explores the artists and music behind the 2015 season of the Aspen Music Festival and School and previews upcoming performances. Please join me Tuesdays at 3:30 and rebroadcast Saturdays at 3 o'clock for more interviews. My name is Chris Moore. Thanks for listening.